getting aid to Venezuela, campaign promises, and Miami's new football coach. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Our digital director, Teresa Frontado, just returned from Colombia. We're going to hear about a trip she took to get aid to Venezuelans. Plus, PolitiFact created the DeSantis-o-meter, just as they had for Governor Rick Scott. And there have been similar meters to track campaign promises for presidents. Also, Manny Diaz is a Miamian. He knows the relationship this city has with the University of Miami football team.
Why would you want to work at a school that doesn't have the expectation of winning a championship?
Diaz is now the coach. We spoke with him about the pressure to bring the U back to prominence. And finally, everyone views death differently. We're going to learn about a new movie by a South Florida director called To Dust. It's a film that'll challenge your view of what happens when we pass using dark comedy. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Venezuelans continue to struggle with the nationwide blackout that goes into its fifth day. Recently, WLRN's digital director, Teresa Frontada, who is Venezuelan, went to Colombia with a U.S. military flight to deliver medical supplies and food to the border. She was there last Thursday with the U.S. Aid Relief Agency, and she joins us now to talk about the journey and how people are getting help into Venezuela. Teresa, great to have you on.
Thank you, Luis. Nice to be here.
All right. The U.S. government is sending aid to Venezuela. Let's hear from Bonnie Glick. She's the deputy administrator for USAID.
On board this aircraft, at the request of the Venezuelan interim president, Juan Guaido, we will have medical supplies. Those medical supplies will include surgical masks, surgical gowns, cleaning supplies, as well as a lot of latex gloves. We were specifically told that in order for the Venezuelan hospitals to get what they need, they need to have materials and medical supplies that will keep infections from spreading.
All right. Teresa, there were, she's talking about medical supplies and food on this plane. You were on the plane. Tell us a little bit about that. What was on there?
Well, in this particular, this was the first military flight that was going to Cúcuta in the border between Venezuela and Colombia since the violent clashes of February 23rd. We were transporting 7 pallets of medical supplies, which weighed around 6 tons. It doesn't sound like they weighed much, but it's because of the content of what was inside the boxes. It was like latex gloves, masks, and things like that that are indispensable for to prevent infections. The U.S. government and the government of Colombia and 3 other Latin American countries have donated more than 600 tons of food and medicine that are waiting in what they call prepositioned along the Venezuelan border.
So it's still not in Venezuela. It's still there in Colombia waiting.
Yeah, yeah. It's in a warehouse located just steps away from the border. They did try to get the aid in on the pass on February 23rd, and that effort ended with more than 400 people wounded, more than 800 people that reported or had to be treated by medical personnel because of asphyxia, and it ended with at least two trucks that were burned down.
We're not hearing anything else though from Venezuela about if aid will ever be allowed into the country.
The Maduro government, the Nicolás Maduro government, has said we do not need humanitarian aid. And in fact, what they wanted to do on February 23rd, they said they were going to send some help into Colombia, into the city of Cúcuta. They have been rejecting this notion that there is a humanitarian crisis in the country, even though several NGOs have done extensive reporting about the dire conditions in hospitals and the dire problems with malnutrition. And there are, according to the latest numbers by ACNUR, the UN Agency for Refugees, there's 3.5 million Venezuelan refugees that have left the country, that have had to leave the country and ask at looking for help.
And you know, I wonder, what do the Venezuelans, or what do we know about what Venezuelans in Venezuela know about these efforts? Because obviously the message is going to be controlled.
Well, this was before the blackout that the country right now is plunging into. There's a lot of activity around Twitter, so the Venezuelan population is aware of the supplies and that the aid is waiting at the border. I don't think that they do not know. I think the problem is that the Nicolás Maduro government still has the support of the military and of the law enforcement. So when the interim government of Juan Guaido tried to get into the country with the aid, they were rejected. And the path was even physically blocked, and the whole situation ended in a violent clashes between Maduro supporters and the volunteers that were trying to bring the aid into the country.
Now you go on this flight with them. You're delivering. What? Tell me real quickly. As you know, it was a quick trip. So you land, you drop everything off. What did you get a chance to talk to anybody?
We started the day at the Homestead Air Force Base, right here in South Florida. That's where the military flight. There has been 7 military flights since the operation started in February 4th. The rest of the aid has been transported via commercial flights and also by land. So we started the day in Homestead, and our crew flew in from Texas. We landed in Cúcuta. The flight was around 4.5 hours because it's a C-130, which is a really sturdy, you know, military plane, but it tends to be slower on the slower side. And we landed in Cúcuta around 1:30. We went to and we saw as the aid was unloaded and taken into trucks, and then we drove to Tienditas warehouse, which is actually where the aid, these 600 tons of aid that are waiting at the border are. There's 2 buildings. There's one for medical supplies and another one that houses food. And they have donations from 5 countries. And when you walk in there, you see everything organized by pallets. And they have the flags of the country that donated the aid, you know, marking everything. So you walk through the aid by Colombia and the aid by the U.S. And I think Chile is also one of the donors.
But it's just still sitting there.
It's still sitting there. We had the opportunity to talk to a Venezuelan legislator, José Manuel Olivares, and he said that they're working on getting the aid in, but they were not going to say they were not going to make the mistake of revealing when and how. They want to prevent the violence that happened on February 23rd.
Real briefly, the country now in its 5th day, I believe, of its blackout.
Yes.
What do we know about what's going on?
Well, it's very hard to know exactly what is going on the ground. The Venezuelan government says nothing. In fact, the Ministry of Defense yesterday spoke and said nothing is happening. They say at first on Thursday evening that it was an attack by the Empire, which is the United States, and particularly they mentioned U.S. Senator Marco Rubio. And that has been their version since Thursday, that this was an attack. The situation, the independent reports that we have been receiving are dire. Because as time goes by, the food and this is a country with hyperinflation, with more than 1% of inflation, where food is very expensive. Food has gone bad, and there's no water. So yesterday there was a video circulating of children in one of the biggest children's hospital in Venezuela. It's a public hospital, screaming through the window, saying, "We're hungry. We're hungry. We don't have water." So the situation is getting dire. The government of Juan Guaido has established an independent information center, if you want, but it's a lot of effort to sift into what's happening, because a lot of areas do not have electricity nor cell phone signal. That's the thing about this blackout that included cell phones too and internet.
It is a nationwide blackout. NPR's been on the story as well. We've been speaking with WLRN's digital editor, Teresa Frontado. Again, recently made a trip along with humanitarian and aid groups to the Venezuelan-Colombian border. And you can see more of her reporting at WLRN.org. Teresa, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. As the situation continues to devolve in Venezuela, many are seeking asylum applications to the United States. PolitiFact Florida recently looked into the issue of Venezuelan asylum seekers to the U.S. Reporter Amy Sherman joins us now to discuss. She'll also be talking about the DeSanto meter, I should say. Amy, great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start with this. There's been a number of statements made by South Florida lawmakers about asylum applications for Venezuelans. How did you go about tracking asylum seekers from Venezuela to the U.S.?
Well, the first thing to know is that we found it's tough for people of various nationalities to get asylum right now, not just Venezuelans. Many fail to meet the high hurdles to get asylum. Asylum seekers have to prove either persecution by the government or fear of persecution. So if you live in Venezuela and you can't find food, medicine, maybe your family has been a victim of crime, it's clearly an awful life, but it doesn't meet the criteria for asylum.
And why is South Florida, Miami specifically, important for tracking this data?
Well, for Venezuelans who flee and choose to come to the U.S., Florida is getting the biggest group, and many come to the Miami area. And if you look at the statistics specifically for the Miami area, you see the small numbers of cases approved. I mean, in September, looking at asylum in general, there were, 300 or so cases approved out of 1,700 completed cases. And denial rates are higher in Miami and Orlando immigration courts than the national average. Now, here, we started looking at a claim by the Florida Democratic Party back when Trump was going to visit Miami. And the Democrats said the Trump administration had denied almost half of the Venezuelan applicants looking for asylum. We ended up not rating the claim and writing a story instead because we couldn't get complete data on all types of asylum applications.
Right, right. And again, this is a story that we're going to keep following, so you can always find more about the crisis in Venezuela at WLRN.org. I want to switch over to this other story that we wanted to talk to you about originally, which is the DeSanto meter. This is not new. I mean, you guys have been tracking governors, and we've been tracking presidents on their campaign promises, and that's basically it, right? You're just tracking all of Governor DeSantis's campaign promises.
Right. Our goal is to hold candidates accountable for those promises they made on the campaign trail. So even years after they made them, when by that point voters have forgotten what their governor promised them they would do. And we did the same thing for Governor Scott. We're also tracking the presidents on our Trumpometer. And we did the same thing extensively for President Obama. When it comes to DeSantis, we decided to look at promises on the environment, healthcare, and education.
And so we're just a couple of months into his first term. I mean, what can we actually start to look at? Because he hasn't really had time, right, to try to keep any of those promises.
Well, the first thing we do is we look at his proposed budget. And DeSantis did unveil a lot of proposals before the legislature convened last week. And we're going to be watching and seeing what happens. For example, he called for an increase to the state's best and brightest program, which is basically a bonus program for highly effective school teachers in Florida. Really, now it's up to the legislature to see if they want to go along with his ideas or not. So we will see what happens by the end of the session. And really, he has 4 years to try to keep these promises.
Talking again with PolitiFact Florida's Amy Sherman. PolitiFact Florida just launched the DeSanto meter, tracking campaign promises by Governor Ron DeSantis. There have been the meters for Rick Scott, for presidents, always tracking these campaign promises, as Amy said, and seeing if any of these candidates actually keep most of these promises. The other thing, too, though, coming back to this idea, because you have the scale, like PolitiFact always has its scale, and on the worst end, I guess, is, the meter is broken, which is really bad. But, how do you determine, if it's they've given up on it, or, they just had a hard time getting other lawmakers to get on board?
I would say broken eventually becomes obvious. Now, in the case of Governor Scott, he made some conservative promises back in 2010 during his primary, for example, to adopt an Arizona-style immigration law. It was very clear early on he just walked away from that process, abandoned it, wasn't talking about it. That was about winning a Republican primary. So in that case, it was clear he broke it and broke it early. In other cases, we're going to really have to watch for 4 years and see what DeSantis achieves before we can give a final rating on a promise. Along the way, he could get a stalled if there isn't much traction. He could get it in the works. If he achieves partial success, we would give him a compromise. And if he fully meets the objectives of a promise, he gets a promise kept.
And what about former Governor Rick Scott? How did he do on his promises?
Governor Scott, we tracked his promises for 8 years, and we tracked several dozen of them. And ultimately, he kept about half his promises. The one that he probably touted the most was to grow 700,000 jobs in 7 years, and we gave him a promise kept for that. Governor Scott set the bar really high in some other areas. He wanted to do away with the corporate tax entirely. He broke that. The legislature didn't want to go along with that. It's interesting that DeSantis set the bar a little bit lower. He talked about lowering that tax, but he didn't call for getting rid of it entirely. So he made it easier on himself, and I think he's keeping in mind what might the legislature be willing to do here, because he needs a partner in the legislature to achieve these promises.
And how many promises does a governor have to keep in order to be seen as an effective leader? Or is that a fair way to judge a governor?
I wouldn't reach a statistical conclusion on that. We decided to really focus this time on fewer promises and keep better tabs on them rather than try to keep track of several dozen promises. You know, you'll notice we did the same thing. We're tracking fewer promises with Trump than we were with Obama back when we tracked a few hundred promises. So, you know, Scott achieved half of his promises, but a lot of it comes down to how the politician sells his progress to the voters when it's time to run for re-election or run for another office. I think for DeSantis, he's going to want to show that he moved the needle, that he improved Florida's education, he improved Florida's economy, he improved our healthcare choices. I don't think he locked himself into many specific numbers to get there.
Well, he did, like any politician, made a lot of promises, lots to track. Of course, he's still early in his political career as governor, and this, as you said, the session is starting, so we shall see. Again, it's the DeSanto Meter by PolitiFact, tracking again Governor Ron DeSantis's campaign promises. What is he going to keep, and what is he going to fail to keep? We've been talking with PolitiFact Florida's Amy Sherman. Amy, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, you can learn more about the DeSanto Meter. Just go to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, a movie made by a local director tackles faith, death, and family. It's a dark comedy with Matthew Broderick. All of that coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. South Florida native Sean Snyder's debut film is a dark comedy that features a most unexpected partnership. Geza Rorick, star of the Academy Award-winning film Son of Saul, plays a cantor in the Hasidic Jewish community who loses his wife to cancer. His character, struggling with her passing and has nightmares over the idea that her body is not yet decomposed and returned to the earth. So he forms an alliance with a stoner biology professor at the local community college, Albert, played by Matthew Broderick. Here's a clip from the trailer.
We have on our hands a woman. She was buried 6 feet under back in June. What's that body going to look like right about now?
Where did you say you were from?
The film follows the bizarre partnership as Schmel seeks real answers to difficult questions like, when do our bodies actually become a part of the earth, and when do we turn to dust? The film opens in theaters across South Florida this week. We have details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Schneider is the film's director and co-writer. Joins us now in studio. Sean, great to have you here, man.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Such a pleasure to have you.
Grew up listening to this station.
Oh, fantastic. And also joining us in studio, the star of the film, Geza Rorick, who is in town for the South Florida release. Geza, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Also to note, by the way, Sean, we should say this, that, you know, this is a welcome back for you because you used to be, you've done Michael Stock's show.
Yeah, many times over a decade ago, which feels like a lifetime. But
so there you go. So this is a little bit of a homecoming for you. You know what? I want to start, Sean, I want to start with you. I mean, you're not Orthodox Jewish. You don't have any direct connections to the forensic anthropology that you bring up in the movie. But Where did the inspiration for this come from? Why do you want to tell this story?
So this film, there are a lot of sort of latent threads throughout my life that took a long time to intersect with this very odd and specific and deeply personal movie. But the sort of emotional core and the earliest foundations of it come from my own experiences with grief. I lost my mom 10 years ago to melanoma down here in South Florida. And I come from a Reform Jewish background, which certainly isn't a Hasidic background, and yet there is a Jewish way of grieving. And if there's timelines and rituals and guideposts through that process of mourning, and I've always found those timelines, sort of that Jewish way of mourning, to be incredibly profound and wise and life-affirming in the face of loss. And yet this experience of my own grief spilling outside of the boundaries of that and needing its own expression. So the movie very much is how do we deal with our cultures of origin? How do we find meaning in an idiosyncratic way alongside that or atop that? And you know, especially with a human experience as universal as loss.
Now, take me back to your youth growing up. Did you grew up in Kendall, but then you also lived in Fort Lauderdale?
Yeah, grew up in Kendall, went to Beth Am Day School.
Yeah.
Was bar mitzvahed at Beth Am Day School, moved up to West Hollywood, Cooper City, and went to middle school and high school at University School. Shout outs to the
So all of that did play some role in helping you to develop this story.
This film was unlocked in a very strange and specific way. It was with this thought about thinking about science and storytelling, and it was incubated with grants from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and this idea of how do we tell stories about science. And somehow that strange gauntlet sort of to put yourself in this box and think about that unlocked all these threads throughout my life. So I studied religion at Harvard as an undergrad. I've had my own journeys with Judaism and the Jewish ethos and all of that. I mean, it was in the soil here in South Florida, my experiences with grief, my foundations of Judaism. And as I've waxed and waned in my own Jewish journey, which is always an ongoing pilgrimage, the foundations, the humanism, the ethics, the dialectic, you know, how do we ask questions with more questions and we remain humble, that idea of sort of human connection and return to the tradition. You sort of go away from it and you come back. All of that foundational stuff, you know, comes from Beth Am Day School. And
this is a very personal story for you. Geza, you approached this project. You have a background in Orthodox Judaism, but what was your first impression when you saw the script?
I was blown away. I was reading it with my wife late night in the bed after putting the kids into bed. And, you know, generally, when you read scripts, you sort of, after 10, 15 pages, you know where it's heading to. And here we were, like, page 50, and we still had no idea what's the next twist or turn's going to be. So I found it very unique, and it was a no-brainer for me to be interested, and especially after meeting Sean. I was very lucky. I joined this whole project, like, a good year before shooting, so we had plenty of time to talk it over with Sean, and this is his first feature, and I felt the movie is in such a good hands. It's a good idea for an actor to engage in a movie when the director actually wrote the script, because then he really knows the ins and the outs.
You know, all right, so a couple of things that I want to ask you about is, and first I think it's really good to understand the foundation of this faith and why the decomposition of a body into the earth is so significant to the beliefs. Help us understand that.
Well, the idea here is that he's being visited by these nightmares, right? He keeps seeing that his body's decay is not as fast or as smooth as it should be. He has visions and all that. So he's very bothered by the fact that his travel to the other side somehow is being stopped or slowed down, and first he wants to help her as much as he can, but later on this becomes almost threatening to him. He could lose his mind in this. Meanwhile, he's a father of twins. He has to be responsible for his sons. So this is a journey of healing. I view this very odd and unlikely friendship that he forms with Albert, played by Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
They both have to step out from their comfort zone. They generally, these folks don't meet. One is a Hasidic Jew and the other one is a pot smoker, a biology teacher in a community college. But somehow they are both lost souls and they have so much to give to each other. And I think I find the movie quite realistic in this way. I think when we go through really hard and dark times, I think we form relationships which we wouldn't necessarily do other times of our lives.
It seemed to me as I'm watching this film, like, you know, your character, and I did what Matthew Broderick's character and everybody else seemed to do in the movie, which is mispronounce the name and think that the character's a rabbi. Yeah. You know, there was the scene, for example, when you go to the not the morgue, you go to you wanted to talk to somebody who sells caskets,
the funeral home.
Yes. Thank you, that's the one, because he went everywhere.
A very Christian funeral home.
Oh my goodness. So he goes there and this guy's trying to sell, you know, basically the casket,
right?
But your character wants to know, how does it deconstruct? That's how he kept saying it, deconstruct. Yeah. And he couldn't get an answer. It was very frustrating for him.
Yeah.
He really wanted to know how long it's going to take and how fast, and because he wanted it to be over.
Yeah, that was his first step in this inquiry. And I think it's part because Hasidic Jews are sort of undereducated scientifically, unfortunately. And since they so much believe, I think he was unprepared for losing her, because I assume the community and the family was just keep saying it's gonna be all right, pray harder. And so even it was stage four and it was predictable that she can't recuperate, I think when it happened it shocked him so bad.
I do think even outside of the specificity of the faith, and the idea of this movie is that, you know, we hope to reach something universal through the very odd specificity, not just of the world and of the science and of the faith, but of the tone, you know, to tap into some universal experience. And I always find that, I don't know, we have very complicated relationships with death and not very healthy relationships with death. I think that these thoughts about a decomposing body are things that we don't want to admit to, societally, individually, culturally. But I think that we all have those questions inside us, and they're macabre and they're morbid, but they're very human questions. And I'm always amazed, whether it's informed by a sense of the afterlife, by religion, and a sense of the soul, we anthropomorphize the dead. We, you know, the most atheistic person will say, I feel like grandpa might be cold down there. And this idea about, even within ourselves, are we torn between, do we want that body to remain pristine, or do we want it to dissemble? You know,
and you know what, because it the character's always having this nightmare, and he sees the wife's toe just basically decompose, but also like almost explode and blossom into what looks like sort of a very ugly flower.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you're basically looking at the skin just open up, and you know, this it's that fear, right, of what's really happening down there, what's really happening to her, what's going to happen to all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talking with Sean Snyder, the director and co-writer of the new film To Dust, which is out in theaters this week. Snyder grew up in Kendall in Fort Lauderdale. Also joining me in studios is the lead actor in the film, Geza Rohrig. And you can find ticket information, screening information on our social media, WLRN Sundial. It is a dark comedy. Really fascinating, though, as we've been hearing, this question of, you know, what does happen afterwards, and how do we handle that? How do we handle the death of a loved one? Now, an essential part of this film, the film's success, is the chemistry between Matthew Broderick and your character, Shmuel. I'm saying it right, right? See, I'm doing what they did in the movie. It's
Shmuel.
Shmuel. Okay. Because right. Everybody kept saying it wrong. Shmuel. Okay, Shmuel's character. And I want to take us to the scene where you bring in a live pig to Albert's house, and you want to kill it to bury it, and Albert has no idea that you're showing up.
You know, this pig probably has a home, you know? It might be some young farm girl's pig that you... Heidi misses her pig, Schmel. Did anybody see you?
I don't think so.
Now, listen, I'm a professor, and you are a rabbi. And I think that you have seriously crossed the stated boundaries of the professor-rabbi relationship.
I'm not a rabbi. I'm a shaliach tzibur.
I don't know what that is.
It's a cantor.
I don't care.
I'm a Jew, Albert.
Oh.
And I just can't. I can't.
I can't. What?
I stole the pig. It is only fair if you kill it.
But what?
First of all, Sean, I had to get Matthew Broderick on board.
This project, again, I keep going back to the fact that it's so deeply odd and strange, and therapy through art and my own mourning process through cinema. And you put this out into the world, and it seems like it's vulnerable and it's the least likely idea that's going to find traction or get greenlit or find its champions. And yet somehow it has, at every single turn, found its champions, and that started with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and producers who serendipitously came on board when they found the script through the Tribeca Film Institute, Emily Mortimer, Alessandro Nivola, Ron Perlman, all incredible actors with their own production company who wanted to make this movie not as a vanity project, but as an idea, you know, just to help bring this movie to life because they found resonance with it. And you're sort of, you know, you daydream about who you might be able to work with, and Matthew Broderick is such a, you know, part of the canon of any child who grew up in the 80s.
Absolutely.
And when you get producers like Emily and Alessandro and Ron, the keys to the candy store are opened up and we can start really daydreaming. And when we stumbled upon the idea of Matthew, it was like a revelation, an epiphany, because it's tethered to his body of work, but I think it subverts it and broadens it in ways that we're not accustomed to seeing. And then he came on, you know, we sat... He was interested, and then the next thing I know, I'm sitting over a bottle of wine with Matthew Broderick, and very quickly, we're not just talking about the practicalities of the film, but about our own experiences with grief and our deceased parents and showing each other pictures of our children on our cell phones and connecting the thematic depths and the emotional depths of the film.
You know, and look, I mean, at its core, this is, again, a movie about death and about grieving, about our belief about death and what happens next. I wanted to get a sense from you, you know, because it's also got these funny moments, and I'm thinking, why am I laughing about this movie? But it is funny, and I'm wondering, like, that relationship you have with Matthew as you guys are working through the scene. Your character is so serious. It's just trying to get an answer, and he's really like, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to help you, but he ends up helping you. And you guys, I mean, you have scenes where you're out burying a pig in the middle of the woods, but, I mean, what was that like working with him?
Well, Matthew Broderick is a great actor. I mean, he has started this at 18, and, you know, he made countless movies, and I'm such a rookie. I was just trying to learn all his secrets, and he's very laid back and easygoing and helpful, so it was really a true pleasure to work with him. Very nice guy.
You know what, I wanted to ask you about, like, for example, one scene, and I wanted to dive into this, into the science of it, which I think is really fascinating. At one point, there's a scene where the two of you go to a body farm in Tennessee, and this is to learn about how bodies decompose. And, you know, these places really do exist. But what did you know about all of this, by the way, Geza, before you started filming?
Well, I knew about the somatic aspect of death actually quite a lot because I was without a green card for 8 years in this country. And one way that I was able to keep myself over the border is that I washed dead bodies. That's what I did.
You wash them?
Yeah, it's a ritual Orthodox thing. You know, male bodies have to be washed before, just like a newborn baby, in a dignified way to prepare them for the big journey. And so that part I was familiar with, but I did not at all know that there are such things as body farms. So you had better ask Sean about that. Because
the body farm scene too, by the way, I mean, you go, the two characters go, and this is, these places exist. Bodies are just left out in the field to decompose, to study how they decompose. You didn't get into one, but I mean,
I visited two. They were incredibly generous and gracious with their time and their insight. They were official scientific advisors on the film, but I couldn't cross that fence to see the bodies. There are seven in the United States, and the seventh is in Florida, up north of Tampa. And they're all based on climate regions, and they're to understand human decomposition for specifically forensic criminology and to sort of advance science and our understanding of that for the ends of justice. And they're just fascinating places, and the science is so young and it's moving at such a breakneck pace that you ultimately realize there are an increasingly infinite number of factors that inform how any individual body is going to decay.
I wanted to ask you real quickly for both of you, what have you heard from audiences on this?
The reactions have been so exciting to get to travel the festival circuit and interact with audiences specifically. I think that, as I said before, in spite of or even because of the odd specificity of the film, it's supposed to tackle sort of the universality and the universality and the idiosyncratic nature of grief. And we connect with audiences, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, who understand that this film, last night at the Boca Jewish Film Festival, somebody said, I feel like this whole fever dream of a movie is an externalized manifestation of his internal process of grieving.
Real quick, Giz, I wanted to get a sense from you. What have you been hearing?
Well, people just keep hugging me after the Q&As. And they say it's a very rare occasion when you have a movie and then you can tear up and have like heartfelt laughs at the same time.
It is a touching, lovely movie, very sad at many times, very funny at many times. Again, Sean Snyder, the director and co-writer of the film. It's called To Dust. It stars Matthew Broderick and Geza Rohrig. Out in theaters this week. You can find tickets and screening information at WLRN Sundial on Facebook or Twitter. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to talk to you. Love the film.
Thanks for having us.
All right, still to come, there are people in South Florida who want the University of Miami to return to greatness. We're going to talk to their new coach, Manny Diaz. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I know football season's still months away, but the Canes football program is gearing up for the new year with a new coach. Manny Diaz was the defensive coordinator under Coach Mark Richt. In his time in that position, the Canes were one of the best defenses in the country, and he brought the team back to prominence. Remember the turnover chain? Well, we met with Coach Diaz at the University of Miami football facilities recently and talked about the team's history and how he wants to bring this team back to greatness, and he started by sharing his favorite memory of UM football.
When I was a kid, you know, going to the big games in the Orange Bowl on the Saturdays, you know, whether it was, I think it was 86, you know, Oklahoma. I think that was that might be one of the game that really put Miami on the map nationally. Certainly, Miami had won a national championship in 83, but that's really when they were sort of taking things over at that time. And Miami, there'd always been big Florida or Florida State games in the Orange Bowl, but this was the first time a major opponent came in and the city just brought it. And it was just, you know, it was just a dominating performance from start to finish. So just all those sort of, you know, magical nights or magical Saturday afternoons in the Orange Bowl just when I was growing up. And really, it was very important because it's, you know, Miami was, it was at a difficult time in the 80s. Miami was going through a lot of different types of growing pains. And the one thing that the city could all come together on was the Miami Hurricanes. It represented us and the diversity of the city and the uniqueness of our culture down here, I think, was all really represented in watching those guys run around and play.
All right, so here's a team with a lot of history, a lot of championships. You're reminded of that every time you walk around. The banners are there. So every coach who's ever been in this position since all of that winning, there's the pressure to live up to a standard, to live up to that history. So you're now the new coach. What's the pressure you're feeling, or how do you approach that?
You don't put pressure on yourself any more than what you would do to do the best job you can do. Everyone understands the expectation here, but why would you want to work at a school that doesn't have the expectation of winning a championship? Why would you want to recruit a player that doesn't want to come to a university where winning national championships is the standard? You know, one thing that I believe in coaching, and whether it's coaching or parenting or running an organization or a company, is that, you know, people will rise to the standards that you set. And so to me, it's a great thing here at the University of Miami where, you know, we can hold our young men to extraordinarily high standards because they understand what the expectation here is. We want to compete for championships here at Miami.
What's the trick in, if there is such a thing, what is the strategy in recruiting? How do you go out there and you're talking to the top talent and you're going to convince some young man, come play for us?
A couple of main things that pop up. Number one, it's about relationships, right? Because ultimately we're in the relationship business, and recruiting is about establishing a relationship with the young man and his family to let him know that you don't just choose a university, you're choosing the people around the university who will, you know, basically look after the student athlete with their best interests in mind, and that can maximize their potential. That's really what this is all about. The second thing, though, and this is where it's really exciting here, what's going on at the University of Miami, is that the young man wants to make sure that we are a big-time program, not just because we can point to our five national championships. So, you know, the brand-new Carroll Soffer indoor practice facility. We've got brand-new dorms on campus that are open, coming online next year that is a game-changer for the University of Miami, what they've done to the stadium. You know, so all these little negatives that people use to recruit against us, they're all slowly going away. So you can tell a young man you don't have to go to, you know, who knows where to play big-time college ball. You can do it at home. Those things maybe didn't matter as much in the 80s and 90s. They matter a lot today. And University of Miami's, I'm fully aware that, you know, me and my staff are the beneficiaries of things that previous head coaches did not have. And it is hard to compete against the current blue bloods of college football without some of the same things that they have.
So I want to ask you real quickly, because you know this is a topic that's discussed nationally from time to time, is the rigors of academics and football and athletes in general. What do you tell parents, you know, when you're sitting down and talking to them and their kids about the education part of it? And that, look, your son, sure, he's going to get the chance to play for a great program, get national exposure. If he has dreams of going to the NFL, we could probably help him get that. But also, look, he's getting an education, and he's not taking simple classes just throw away because it's football. I mean, what's that conversation like with parents? How do you ease their concerns?
Well, you mentioned the key word, which is education. A lot of colleges will sell that you'll get a degree, and you can get a degree, but getting a degree and getting an education are two different things. And one thing that stands out with the University of Miami compared to the people that we recruit against is that we are a private school. We have a small student body. A lot of our recruits don't know that we're a private school at first glance. We have a small student body. You're not going to be in a classroom with, you know, hundreds of kids. And when they start looking at our average class size, and that you're going to have a personal relationship with your professors, the people that teach you, instead of, you know, having to call it a teaching aide or a graduate assistant, that if you have to ask a question, it's hard to ask a question, you know, when you've got 150 kids in a classroom. So those are the things that really make University of Miami stand out academically, because we know, I mean, you can be later in life, you can have a piece of paper that said you got a degree, but you can still not have the education that really it takes to find value in your life after football. The one thing we guarantee all these young men, at some point in your life, someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say you can't play this game of football anymore. And the what next is a lot longer part of your life than the what now. And if they're not prepared for that, if we're not preparing for that, then we're really doing them a disservice.
You're listening to a conversation with the University of Miami football coach Manny Diaz. A Miami native, Diaz became the coach of the U at the end of 2018 after coach Mark Richt announced his retirement. We are speaking with Diaz about his plan for the team this year, the turnover chain, and how he's trying to keep players safe from head injuries. Of course, the other thing when you talk about football is the thing that kind of dominates a lot of the conversation these days is the issue with head injuries. Now, the NFL is putting all this effort into trying to reduce that. What has college football done to try to reduce that?
It has to be first and foremost in my mind, because I'm going into these living rooms, and again, the most valuable resource to this family is their child, and they're putting me in charge of their child. So if I don't have their well-being in everything we do, I'm not worthy of holding the position I hold. But that has to mean something. So, you know, certainly we've changed rules in the way the game is played. That's had a profound impact. The biggest thing for us is, and this will be my sixth year now, we changed the way that we tackle. We took the head out of the tackle, and that's made a profound impact in the safety of the players we've coached and the amount of head injuries that we've had through tackling. And you can play this game. You can play this game in a safe way. There's no doubt that there was a culture around football that in the past, I still can't get my dad to drink water if we're playing golf, because, you know, he thinks that drinking water means that, you know, you're taking the easy way out. You know, it's like, no, you should drink water. You know, I mean, but those are some of the more, I hate to say, but barbaric, you know, coaching methods of yesteryear. And those things are gone. You know, they had to go. And there's too much information out there. And we want to sell that we can make this game as simply safe as possible for the young men to play it.
Talk about culture.
And this, I mean, this is something that was promoted in obviously the two documentaries, the U and the U Part Two, but it was just something that UM was known for, was it, its culture. It had a certain, they say swagger, but that the team on and off the field composed itself a certain way. And there were a lot of other teams in the league that kind of didn't like that, but that was, I guess, part of the UM culture. Or is that inaccurate to say that? You've seen it. You grew up with it.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that other people didn't like Miami, and that's still true. But I think that goes back into the city. You know, Miami is one city that it doesn't matter where you are in the country. If you just say Miami, everyone in a word association game, everyone has an image that pops up. And it's certainly not always positive. Our culture, our football culture, a lot of times reflects the culture from the way high school football here is played and coached, the way that youth football here is played and coached. Just our, I mean, to me, our culture as a whole, we're a passionate community, you know, we're a community that enjoys having fun. You know, this is a community, you know, the music and the dancing to me is all part of the cultures, and they all have sort of mixed through the University of Miami. And that, a lot of times, that didn't fit in very well with some of the teams that we were playing from the Midwest. And it was a cultural, it's hard to have a, you know, the Miami Dolphins can play the Pittsburgh Steelers, and half of Pittsburgh's team can be from Florida. You know, but generally speaking, when Miami played, you know, Notre Dame back in the day, or Miami played Oklahoma or Nebraska, you were seeing two different cultures on the field. And a lot of people didn't like the Miami culture. Now, what was our mentality on that? We loved it, right? Because that was us. And Miami has always had a little bit of this us against the world, you know, viewpoint. And I think that's represented the Miami Hurricanes.
Something that got a lot of attention was obviously the turnover chain. And all the other teams have been trying to copy it. Where did the idea come from, and why did you think that this could be something that unifies a team and isn't taken the wrong way?
Really, all we wanted was more turnovers. We didn't even think past that. You know, we in 2016, we were excellent in a lot of categories defensively. We did not create a lot of turnovers, and people had different turnover props. We didn't invent the first turnover prop, and we were trying to brainstorm on something that was very uniquely Miami and would really fit in, and we kind of went back and forth, and somebody in the room, this is in our defense staff room, and somebody, you know, chimed in saying, hey, what about a Cuban link? And half the guys in the room didn't really know what a Cuban link was. I think they thought it was a spicy Cuban sausage, you know, but once we, you know, people some Google a couple of pictures, and once we saw it, it was a runaway. There could be no other winner. We were unaware of the phenomenon it would become, but maybe that's why it works so well. Because if we had wanted it to be, you know, if our intentions were to connect to the community and do all this, I don't know if we'd ever come up with the idea. I think the fact that it was so pure and organic, that's in a way why it caught on so well.
So I read somewhere there's talks of maybe an offensive chain of some sort, or some symbol to use on the offense. Is that true?
Well, yes. I mean, all those guys now look at me, right? And they're like, Coach, you're our coach now too. And you know, it's no fair that the defensive guys get to have all the fun. So we'll brainstorm. Like I said, the idea is still in the oven, but it's cooking right now. But we'll probably have something in the fall that let our offensive guys have some fun.
How are you moving the team forward? I mean, do you want to go back to what it used to be, or are you trying to reshape this in your own way? What is that? You know, for you, what is it, your legacy that you want to leave?
Well, you want to hold, number one thing you're going to do is you're going to hold a standard. You have to create a standard. You have to create the core values in terms of how we're going to define ourselves. And that should match with, A, the culture of the university as a whole. And then second, what you believe in as a head coach. So we've had a chance to establish all that. But really, you don't get to spend a lot of time really stepping back and thinking about, wow, you know, we've got this opportunity. You got to get to work. And there were, you know, we did not have a great season a year ago. And there were some obvious things, there were some obvious problems that we had to address. And I think any leader, you know, rule one is you have to address your issues. And, you know, slowly but surely this offseason, you know, we've been trying to address our issues. That doesn't mean that they're all solved. Doesn't mean that they will all necessarily be solved by this fall. But the most important thing is to know where you're strong, know where you need to get better, and then have a plan in place to try to get to that point. Because, again, we all know the standard and the expectation for Miami, so it's time that we have to get the right people on the bus, you know, to take us to where we need to go.
And again, I mean, do you feel any of that pressure? Because new coach, so people are like, all right, we're going to come back to what we used to be. I mean, do you ever feel that from the community? Does anybody ever come up to you whenever you're out somewhere and like, coach, can't wait to get back to that, all that winning we used to do?
Yeah, and that's just my family. So I can imagine, but no one wants it more than I do, and that's the thing. I mean, no one wants it more than anybody on the staff, and no one wants it more than the players in our locker room. So it's impossible, really, for anyone to hold or to put more pressure or to hold us to a higher standard than we hold to ourselves. And I think if we understand that and we understand how we're defined and we know how these things are built and how college football programs are built and something we want, something that is sustainable for the long term, I think we feel really good about where we're at.
And that is University of Miami head football coach Manny Diaz. You can see a video interview that we did with him on techniques that the team is using to prevent concussions. You can find it on our Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Also, we want to hear from you. What do you think the team's going to do this upcoming season? Share with us on Facebook, again, at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.